Good evening, listeners. It is the 13th of May, 2018, and you're tuned in to 88.7 KBVR Corvallis. It is currently just after 7 p.m., and on a Sunday, that can only mean one thing. It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Adrian Gallo.
And I'm Harrison Steerwalt. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about the awesome things that we do at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and should they occur, any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. And tonight, we are lucky to be joined by Christina Hospitarth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about what you do and kind of the college that you work under.
Sure. So I am completing my master's in kinesiology and adapted physical activity, specifically is the kind of subdivision I'm in, which is in the College of Public Health and Human Sciences.
Very cool. And so... Who's your advisor, just real quick?
Dr. Sam Logan.
Dr. Sam Logan, okay. Mm-hmm. And how far along are you in your master's program?
I am wrapping up, so I should be graduating in June.
Oh, man, that is awesome. Congrats with that.
Thank you.
We'll get to a little bit more of that in a bit. So
what
specifically are you doing with your, what are you going to be talking about with your defense?
Sure. So a lot of the work that I do involves Go Baby Go. So Go Baby Go is a community-based outreach program that provides modified ride-on cars to kids with disabilities as a source of self-directed mobility. There's kind of a lot of unwrap there.
So yeah, before we get too far, let's get into what is a ride-on car.
Yes. So a ride-on car is very simply the toy cars that if you have any younger relatives, they likely have one. You can buy them from Walmart, Toys R Us, just those sorts of Barbie Jeep type cars.
Okay. So all of the little cars that we all wish we had when we were little.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't have one. I wasn't lucky.
I didn't.
So my little, I think I had like a four-wheel truck that I went over like a teeny bit of like some grass and thought I was super cool.
That's pretty good.
But oftentimes these cars are the way you kind of mobilize them is with a foot pedal or something. So tell us a little bit about what you do to modify these cars and what kind of population they serve.
Mm-hmm. So to modify them, we electrically modify them. So we change the activation switch. So instead of the foot pedal or a really tiny button that's hard to press without really good fine motor skills, instead, it's a really big, easy-to-press activation switch, or some of the other models are a little bit more advanced where you have to stand in order to power them. But the big idea is just that it's an easier-to-press big switch that's often, it seems silly, but like the biggest barrier to being able to use them is just that kids with disabilities don't necessarily have the muscle tone to press a foot pedal.
And so you said kids with disabilities. So is that mostly the population that uses these modified ride-on cars?
Yep. So why this emerged is because mobility during early childhood is really important. It mm-hmm. helps kids learn. It provides perceptual information. And so when kids with disabilities have motor delays or just limitations in mobility, that can have consequences on other domains. So by not being able to move, you don't have access to the same experiences that typically developing kids would.
Can we talk about that a little bit more? Because I think when we discussed it earlier, we kind of glossed over it. But the idea that you have the freedom to move around at your own will and kind of look at a mural on the wall or kind of sit and stare at a flower or go knock off some like water off the table. I mean, can you explain what are the upstream effects of kind of not being able to have that freedom of movement?
Yeah, so there's a long history of research looking at active mobility versus passive mobility. So the difference between being pushed in a stroller or in this case a wheelchair maybe versus being able to crawl, walk, move on your own. So there's a lot of research looking into effects on development for kids once they start walking. And so there we see that kind of their visual information is better. They're able to process that better. Spatial cognition improves. They have better spatial memory. And so we see all of these things arise as kids are able to move of their own will. So you don't really have access to these experiences that have inherent learning characteristics in them until you are able to go there. So if you see something and you want to figure out how it works or why it works, you can't really do that unless you can get there. And that extends to even smaller movements. So until you have postural control, until you even have head control, you can't really direct your vision somewhere to look at something. You can't manipulate something in your hands. And so you don't learn about the world the same way that typically developing kids would.
And so you, I'm going to go back to when we talked earlier this week. You gave an example of an individual in the hospital setting. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us that again? That was
a
really good example.
Of course. So this was a study that was conducted in a hospital-based setting. It was three kids with different disabilities. They kind of had full-time care, and whenever they were transported through the hospital, it was already always passively, so pushed in a wheelchair. And so these kids got modified ride-on cars, and the first time this one girl received a modified ride-on car, well, first she was thrilled, and then in driving down the hallway that she's been pushed by hundreds of times probably, she actually stopped in front of the mural that she's passed every day and looked at it, touched it, paid attention to it, and she never showed any interest in it before. So it really changes how kids attend to the environment when they're in control of that, because she never expressed any interest, or maybe the first time she was passed by it, she did, but the person moving her didn't notice that, and if she didn't have any reaction from showing that interest, why would she express interest again? But this time she was able to stop and look at it on her own.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like such a small thing to be able to look at the picture on the wall that you've kind of walked past by. But again, like you said, whether there's the curiosity or just the awe and wonder or something that you wanted to be able to kind of experience but you couldn't before. Let's talk about another aspect that these modified vehicles that you make kind of help to address. What is the cost of a pediatric wheelchair?
Right. So if we know that movement is important and kids with disabilities don't have access to that, then kind of the first line of thought is, okay, then we give them movement. And so the first option there would be powered wheelchairs. But powered wheelchairs cost a lot of money. For pediatric powered wheelchairs, they can cost around $17,000, and that can fluctuate. There are slightly cheaper ones, but that's basically what you're going to pay once you're adding the modifications that you need to make it safe and accessible for that child.
Can you say that one more time? How much does it cost?
Yeah, $17,000 and or more. Yeah,
so,
that's a lot.
I mean, talk about a barrier to entry.
Right.
And absolutely.
And that would be so for somebody who, like, they may be potentially in a wheelchair for their entire life.
Right. And so the other part of that is that there's kids who have motor delays but will eventually walk, but they're still having this delayed experience. And when you think about child development, critical periods, then if you're not having that same movement experience, not only at all, but at the same time, that's also important. So making sure that these kids get these experiences at the same age as their typically developing peers is also a really critical piece. And that also factors into insurance. So insurance definitely will not cover something if a child doesn't quote-unquote need it because they will eventually walk.
Right. And just to put it into perspective, so you said the modified electric wheelchair is like $17,000.
Yes.
How much do these modified ride-on cars cost after you do everything to them?
Yeah, so ride-on cars are about $200 to $300. So quite a difference. Quite a difference.
I mean, I'm just thinking about like the order of magnitude that, you know, insurance, this is the only kind of way that insurance will allow you to kind of get a kind of like moving vehicle for a child if they satisfy, you know, your child needs this versus, oh, there's a delay in kind of growth and in development. So your child doesn't quote unquote need it. Mm-hmm. So too bad. Now you just have to wait.
And there's actually no device for kids 2 and under. So when you kind of really backtrack into when would be the best time to give it, and in early intervention and intervention for kids in general, the answer to that is always as soon as you can. So if there's no device at all for kids 2 and under, then that's a huge gap right there.
And so this would just, if these were modified ride-on cars were made very easy to get, then that would just break a huge barrier that could be useful for so many growing up children.
Yeah, absolutely.
So can you describe to us this program called Go Baby Go and kind of how it started and what your part of this and Oregon State in general is doing to kind of help this move forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So Go Baby Go started at the University of Delaware. A physical therapist there named Cole Galloway kind of recognized this very apparent gap in access. So this idea that these kids really need this device, there's a ton of kids that would benefit from it. No device exists for kids 2 and under, or it's super expensive. And so from there, him and his students actually kind of brainstormed, and I think they just went to Toys R Us, and then they were like, oh, this is the answer right here.
If you go to our blog, there's a link to one of the YouTube videos where they interview him, I think through NSF, and he tells the story of they were in, I think, Home Depot, and they were buying all of the ride-on cars, and the manager is running out. They're like, why are you buying all of our cars? You can't do that. And he says, well, we're having a lab meeting. We need these.
He's a really awesome guy. And so it just kind of blossomed from there. And so some of the, you can kind of see the progression of how the ride-on car models have evolved, and the process has gotten a little more streamlined. But there are now multiple chapters of Go Baby Go, so it's expanded wide and far from University of Delaware. It came to OSU because my advisor, Sam Logan, did his postdoc with Cole. And so then he brought Go Baby Go to Oregon when he started working here. And he collaborates with OHSU, and they also modify cars there, serve kind of more of the greater Portland area. And we also provide cars to kids in the community.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And so I want to kind of step back to something you said earlier. Mm-hmm. You talked about how one of the modified cars, there's a big button that you can press. And then you talked about how there's some other ones that you also have where you have to do a standing motion to make the car go. Can you kind of unpack that a little bit for us?
So this new version is called a sit-to-stand ride-on car. And so here, instead of having the big button switch, there's a reverse-activated switch built kind of under the seat. So the child can't even see it. They don't know that it's there. And this is more an ATV quad-style car, to kind of picture it a little bit better. Otherwise, you're like, how is this kid standing up in this car?
Yeah.
So basically, since it's reverse activated, the child has to pull to stand and remain standing in order to power the car. So when there's weight on the seat, the car stops. And when there's not weight on the seat, the car will go. So this idea being that you're incorporating more functional training, which is more similar to traditional physical therapy practice, with this experience of powered mobility.
So I see this as, this is really incentivizing the physical therapy aspect.
Yes.
And, you're actively working your body. You're actually kind of developing this muscle memory and more nerve connections, but you're making it really fun at the same time. So was that the main objective to make this work?
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. And that's 100% what we've seen. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot less research being done with the sit-to-stand car. A lot of my thesis is using the sit-to-stand car, so I've been unpacking that a little bit, as well as some of my lab mates here at OSU. But we see that parents will report this too, that they try to get their child to practice standing outside of the car, and they won't do it. Mm-hmm. And it seems like if that was the only experience you had, that they actually can't do it, that they can't pull to stand.
Yeah.
And then you see them in the car and they drive for 20 minutes straight and you're like, okay.
We knew you could do it.
it's part of that motivation is a huge piece of it.
And so, is there like a progression? Do you start with the big button and then move to the sit-to-stand car?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say there's an established protocol. With my thesis, it was looking at a basically 1-year intervention for babies with Down syndrome that started at 7 months, just to give you kind of a perspective of how young.
Mm-hmm.
It's very young.
Very young.
And they started in the seated car, and then once they could pull to stand, bear weight, etc., that's when they transition to the sit-to-stand car. Mm-hmm. And then with this intervention, they also introduced the idea of the sit-to-stand car being used as a power push device. So because of that reverse activation, if nobody's in the seat, the car will essentially start going. And so with the power push mode, you can stand at the back of the car, kind of hold on to a little bar, and the car can go really, really slowly, but you have to step to keep up with it. And if you think about 12 months in the life of a 15-month-old, that's a long time that they've had this car, and it's been a big part of their life. So once again, providing this progressively more challenging training with this car that they're comfortable with. It's basically just a part of their life at this point.
Sure.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And how do they react? Like, are they super stoked about the last version of the car where they're pushing it themselves, or are they not as excited because they're not sitting in the car anymore?
I think they're pretty stoked.
Yeah.
This was done in Cleveland, so I have all the video data, so I've been able to see all of that. But it's pretty fun to, it's almost, I want to say more fun to do it in kind of that scenario, but you can see kind of the changes a little bit easier, I think, because you watch things back to back, and seeing the progression of the different kids has been really neat.
That's really cool.
So what were some of your initial findings on, you know, were there correlations on how much the children improved versus how much time they spent using the modified ride-on cars?
Yeah, so we wanted to look at the onset of independent driving and the onset of independent walking in relation to dosage. So trying to get at sort of this first insight into a dose-response relationship of, if the kids use the car more, do they get more benefits? How do these outcomes that we see relate to how they use the car? Which is really common question in pediatric rehab literature, but it's not something that we've really looked at with the ride-on cars before. Everything so far has been mostly feasibility, and that's supporting that, yes, kids can do this, and they love it, which is awesome.
Yeah.
But yes, for my thesis, trying to get a little bit more at dosage and walking. And there, it looks like it's hard to say that if a child uses it more, that they get more benefits, just because it's not designed that way. You don't know what they would have looked like otherwise. But I would say that from a broad level, just at kind of parsing out kids of similar ages at entry or similar other characteristics, because then you also have different cognitive levels and things like that that just complicate things. But overall, it seems like kids who are more, at least more adherent, tend to have better outcomes. So learn to drive a little bit faster. The four kids in this study who stayed in the intervention until the onset of walking actually were four of the earliest walkers. And they were also the four who used the power push mode until the end. So that seems to suggest that the power push mode is maybe especially important. They were also the youngest kids at entry, so age of entry might be important, which is a big thumbs up to early intervention, that the kids who started the earliest walked the earliest. That's actually a really, really good finding from the perspective of that. But yeah, there's a lot of little details that say this might be a good thing to look at and this might be a good thing to look at. It's hard to definitively say that there's this linear relationship. And there's likely some amount of threshold too, which would follow most of the just general learning literature.
Yeah, and it seems like your thesis project is really kind of opening up doors to what the next thing could be to look into further. You said starting early could be important, using it could be important, the power push could be important. So it's getting information while also getting new questions, like all research does.
Yes, and I think our goal has always been for the future to have larger samples, to have randomized controls. It's just, it is hard with disability research, and it could always be frustrating. Well, I'll go to the stats department and they'll be like, yeah, next time, just get more kids. And you're like, okay, I'll get right on that.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's all kinds of interesting ethics discussions of
like,
what is my control group that doesn't get these run-on cars, so you can get at an actual causal relationship.
And that's probably the biggest barrier of how do you rationalize having a control group when you feel so firmly that this is important.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, you need statistics to tell you this is important, or can you say, let's get as many kids as early as we can to use these modified ride-on cars, because you know what? I don't like stats either some days. Don't tell anybody. But actually, looking to the future, you're going to be finishing your master's soon, and I want to jump into the future and then go back to your past. But this research that you have done has kind of produced another set of interest and curiosity for you that you're going to pursue in a PhD program.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So in the fall, I'll be going to NYU studying infant motor development with Karen Adolf, who's a really kind of prominent researcher in infant development. So she looks at a lot of kind of what are the drivers and constraints of natural locomotion, why do babies explore, And a lot of that, it seems totally different from looking at kids with disabilities, but you need that typically developing information in order to know what to look at for kids with disabilities, how do you target interventions, and it kind of is starting more at the ground up. So I feel like I always say I'm backtracking, but it's not really backtracking. It's just that sometimes I feel like I don't know enough about typically developing babies to be able to think really critically about how to design an intervention appropriately for a baby with a disability. And we also don't know so much about why typically developing babies move that thinking about these things and how we even assess babies with disabilities may be wrong. So
right.
I think it ends up being kind of more where my interests have ended up here.
And so you're looking more into what is the not justification, but what's the motivation for a typically developing child to go explore?
And what
can they get back from that? So you can actually relate that even further to kind of more what you're doing right now. So am I getting that right?
Yeah. No, I was thinking I was in my head for a second because I think a lot of it boils down to we take so much for granted with babies that it's just like, yeah, they just learn. But I think
there are some things
that we're just like, yeah, I don't really know why. They just do. That's what they do. but yeah, they've done a lot of, and like really recent research of, oh, if it's an empty room versus a room with toys, do they move differently? And the answer is not really. And before they did that, they're like, yeah, they'll definitely move more with the room with toys.
Right.
So it's all these things that we just kind of assume or take for granted that we're realizing that we don't really know. And so when you think about how you assess kids with disabilities, like, oh, are they moving in a goal-directed way? Well, if a typically developing baby doesn't necessarily move in a goal-directed way, then why would you expect a baby with a disability to move that way? So we need to know more about both groups, but I think starting with typically developing makes more sense.
Mm-hmm. So this leads to another question of how your interest in this field typically started.
Yeah. So I feel like I have a strange path, but I had majored in health and exercise science in my undergrad. I went to Wake Forest in North Carolina with the intent of pursuing pediatric physical therapy when I graduated. And then I started getting involved in research my senior year. So it was never really something that I was driven to do. It wasn't something that I did my whole undergrad career, like I see a lot of the undergrads in our lab doing, and I think that's awesome. But that is not where my head was.
It just so happened that in your senior year, there was an opportunity. And
yeah, one of my professors had reached out. It wasn't even me who reached out and asked me to work on this study. And that was kind of the first steps into it. And then I had done my honors thesis. And I think especially the honors thesis process of even writing it and working through kind of all of the questions and how do you design this to answer what you're trying to answer was really interesting to me. I just really liked the thought process behind it. And so when I was thinking about applying to PT schools, I kind of wanted to pump the brakes a little bit. And so I did. And then I worked for a little bit in a public health setting. And then I started looking back at grad programs and I found Go Baby Go. And to me, when I found Go Baby Go, it felt like kind of the perfect combination of the elements of pediatric PT I really liked, where it's these really creative innovative solutions to getting kids to do these things that you need them to do, but you can't do it in the way that you would tell adults to do it, right? Like you can't say, yeah, go do 10 leg lifts in the corner. Like kids not going to listen to you.
Yeah.
So it felt like it had that, but it also had that piece of research that I really liked.
And you said, so you had some time between your undergraduate and coming here to Oregon State.
Mm-hmm.
You said you worked in public health?
Yeah. So I worked as a medical record abstractor for a cardiovascular heart study with the public health department at Wake Forest Medical Center.
Okay. And just not your cup of tea, the public health, or?
I took that job because when I graduated, I felt like I wanted to go to grad school. I didn't think it was PT school, and I thought public health might be a good fit. And then I did that, and it was not. It was not the fit for me.
Yeah.
But I really loved being, again, in that environment, just having different people working on different things. It was a really neat environment, but it wasn't the type of lens that I necessarily wanted.
So the right direction, but still needed to...
You
found your little niche
kind
of going forward. Yeah.
Took me a while, but I got there.
Yeah.
So you described during your senior thesis, you really enjoyed mm-hmm. the process. Can you tell us a little bit more about maybe what your favorite part of that process was?
Yeah, so I had a really excellent advisor, and I had actually, he had helped me, gosh, it's going to be a roundabout story, but he had helped me write a grant for the summer before to do this trail in Spain, kind of like the AT or PCT.
Cool.
And I wanted
that's
to
the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific
yes,
Crest Trail.
Sorry. So it's a yes, it's a 500-mile trail in Spain, and I had studied abroad in Spain, and I'd heard about it, and everything I heard about was just it was so interesting to me because all these people went and then they came back and they're like, I feel so rejuvenated. That was the most refreshing experience of my life. And I had been taking a health psychology class, and we'd been learning about mindfulness, and I felt like it was kind of this embodiment of mindfulness and movement. And I was also majoring in Spanish, so to give more context, it yes. felt like kind of, this perfect connection between sure. my two majors. And so I had come back from that, and I was really impressed by the importance of social connection, which is not something that I had thought about before. And so I came back, and I wanted to kind of explore this relationship between social and movement, which is kind of exactly where I am right now. My lab is called the Social Mobility Lab. So everything kind of wraps up eventually. Yeah. And my advisor was really, really great. And he'd been running this large kind of exercise intervention for older adults. And so we incorporated this little kind of social connectedness dimension to measure that and see if people who felt better about their social connectedness did better in the intervention. And so being able to link these things that I was interested in and that he'd helped me with in the past, and he was just so open to kind of helping me there. It was just a really, I had never experienced anything like that before. And it was just, I owe a lot to him. So thanks, Dr. Rajeski.
Nice. Well, maybe you can go say hi to him on your way over to New York.
Yeah, maybe.
So with that, we're coming to the end of our show, but we have two traditions that we like to end on. And the first is we like to ask you for advice for your past self or any other undergrads that are looking to go to grad school. So what is your advice and who is it to?
Okay. So I thought about this a lot. I feel like to myself, I could have a 5-page list of advice. But my general advice that I think is most important is actually it's kind of wrapped up in a quote from Stephen Covey, who wrote 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And it's don't prioritize your schedule, schedule your priorities. And I think being really intentional with your time is really crucial to being successful. Mm-hmm. And I also think that ties into my second favorite piece of advice, which is to not fall into a comparison trap, because I think people have different priorities. And when you kind of compare how you're spending your time to how other people are spending their time, it's really a waste of energy. So I think over and over you hear block your time and do this and do that. But I do think that it is really, really crucial. And I don't think I was very good at it last year. And I think I'm a lot better at it this year. And I definitely see the benefits.
Yeah. And it's something that is so easy to not do. I mean, it definitely takes effort, but I feel like there would have some really, really big benefits from doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so our second tradition is for us to play you out to a song that you'd like us to play for you. And so what song did you pick and why did you pick it?
Okay. I chose Ain't No Mountain High Enough by Tammy Terrell and Marvin Gaye for a lot of reasons. It is one of my favorite songs. It is often my alarm in the morning. And we spoke a little bit before the show, but it has kind of a neat origin history. And actually with the main lyrics, it was originally talking about success. So the you in the song referenced success. And I think the fact that it is now a love song is lovely, but I like the idea that it was originally a success song.
So with that, we will kick it off with Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell, as requested by Christina. So we wish you all the luck in the future. I'm sure you'll do great at NYU, and you're going to do great at your defense presentation tomorrow.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks.